Hello, my fellow music lovers. I'm Allison Hagendorf, and welcome to the show. This is where we celebrate the universal love of music and the rock and roll spirit that lives in each of us. I'd love for you to hit the subscribe button if you're watching on YouTube, or follow the show if you're listening. I'm so glad you're here. My guest today is the Grammy-winning producer, songwriter, and co-founder of Linkin Park, Mike Shinoda. We talk all about this new era of his solo music, how his love of rock started with rap, and what he learned from Rick Rubin. He shares Linkin Park stories you haven't heard before, the possibility of a reunion, and we bond over our mutual love of Mr. Rogers. And stay tuned after the interview for my sound advice. New music you need to know. It all starts now.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
I want to congratulate you on this new era of Mike Shinoda.
Thank you. All right.
The haircut announcement. I mean, that was fresh.
I think that the every time I change my hair, for some reason, my fans, Linkin Park fans, are like, what are you putting out? And I'm like, I'm just changing my hair. So that being the case, this time I did it intentionally. But like before, I was just like, there have been times in the last like 3 or 4 years where I've just gotten a haircut and they're right. Like, is music coming? I'm like, no, I just got my hair.
Meanwhile, I'm upset not to see it today, but I know that's a very high maintenance look.
Yeah, I did for those who don't know, when I released this new song, I had shaved, I couldn't do it. I had a barber shave these like lines into my head. What had happened before that was I was just doing like, it was the equivalent of like Tumblr blogs of like images. Like I just collected all these cool images that I liked. And
it was like a mood board.
It was. And because I was kind of just trying to like, I don't know. I feel like I was putting out a new song. I didn't want to just do that. Like I wanted to dive deeper into like the release of it and like almost like the world, do more like world building underneath it, which sounds conceptual, but it wasn't like there aren't like characters and like fictional narratives and whatever. It was just vibes. I just wanted to create more vibes and share more of the vibes as the song came out. Almost more like a gallery art show.
Yes.
Like you go and you're just like soaking in, oh, this is like what this person is communicating, right? So the song is one piece of that. And then there's all this other stuff. And part of that, I like saw a great picture of the lines in the head. I was like, oh, that's so cool. And I just decided to do it. We shot some great photos. And it's like, I've never put so much like emphasis on a photo shoot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not anytime recently as I did on.
But it was a moment. It really is a moment. I mean, you've been working so prolifically with other artists and writing with and producing for. So this was really, you know, your moment. I feel like it's your first song,
dude,
that you've done completely by yourself.
Starting this conversation with this part of it is such a red herring. It's like, this is like. Okay, let me recalibrate us real quick.
Okay.
You're running this interview,
like,
and I'm just like, I'm like getting, I'm, it's like, I'm being like, I don't know. I'm like micromanaging your show.
Look, this is a safe space.
You're gonna let me do that?
Go ahead. What do you
people aren't watching. It's like, I watch Allison all the time. She's the greatest. Who does Mike think he is? Like coming in and being like, let me change the subject.
Because I really know like your background as an artist,
a multifaceted
artist. And I always know every time you put out a song, I always know the artist you're working with. So for me, I recognize, okay, this is a moment for Mike. It's been a minute since he's completely, you've played every instrument, wrote, produced. I mean, this is literally you.
So the context of that, that's correct. I spent the last few years, like I'd say like five-ish years ago, I was starting to write more with other people. I spent a few years doing that. And then, 2020 happened. And then even during that time, I was like doing Zoom sessions with people mm-hmm. and like, you know, there was some of it that was like, I want to write with this really interesting artist an artist like Lynn from Paris or K-Flay or G-Flip or, oh, these are all women. Did I work with any guys? Grandson.
Swago.
And Swago. Okay, great. So now we've got
I got you. Yeah. I know everything. Yeah. I know everything you work
on. So work, you know, those and others. And, you know, a lot of stuff didn't come out. You know, a bunch of stuff did. I ended up like, I feel like I started to realize that I was working in a capacity where I was doing the best I could to make great stuff for them. And but it was their song. Mm-hmm. Like it, you know, and I also realized, oh man, the things that I have worked on for myself, like the song Happy Endings,
yep.
It was a bit of an experiment. It was like, oh, you know, I did it with Taylor Upsall and Ian Dior. I barely knew Taylor at the time and I didn't really know Ian at the time. And we had all kind of just like, it had all just kind of come together and put it out and it did very well. But it was a very much sonically and lyrically and everything was very much a departure, right? Like it wasn't core to what people think of me as or Linkin Park or whatever. And so that's why it was fun. So yeah, so I was looking back at all that, like a later part of last year and realizing, oh man, I haven't done anything lately in years that's just been me.
Yeah.
Like just like from beginning to end, I wrote it. I like wrote all the instruments, did all the stuff, and there's no feature. There's no features vocally. Nobody else is like putting in their two cents on any of the, you know, any of the parts. And
yeah.
So that's what already over became, I think that was one reason why it was exciting is because it was like, you know, just me.
It's so exciting. And the reaction has already been so positive. I mean, it's climbing
up
the radio charts, both alternative and rock. I mean, when this is happening, how does this feel for you to know that you're sort of entering into this new chapter? Like, where's your headspace at?
I'll tell you the thing that was the most notable or exciting to me right off the bat was when I started putting things up on socials and we put up something on YouTube, the comments underneath, I feel like it's a lot of the old school fans were showing up and saying, this is my favorite thing you've done in a while. Like they were like, I feel the thing that I love about Linkin Park and about you is in this song. And I think that's because it's more obvious to them or it's in there in a greater percentage or something because there wasn't anybody else involved.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's why. So I like that. I mean, that was to me, that was like almost like if this was a video game, that would be the first checkpoint.
Right?
You get to that checkpoint, you're like, damn, I got, you know, that was good.
Yeah, I mean, I love this song. I love it. And I've been following everything you've been doing. And I get it because you're such a multifaceted artist as a producer, writer. Like you could do really anything sonically, genre wise. You've always been defying genre. So that's not a thing.
I like to hear that, but I don't agree with that. What I learned in playing and writing with so many people in the last few years is I go, I realize there's a lot of things that I'm capable of doing, but I'm not necessarily capable of doing them super well.
Right.
So it's almost like I realize I can get in my own way because I am capable with a thing, but I really like, it probably would be better to hand it over to somebody else. So I started doing that more. And then I learned more about how great people do the thing.
Yes.
I got to sit in with people who are incredible at specific instruments, people who are incredible with pop songwriting, which I was like, I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
I have my way. Like yeah. I have my like when you grow up in a band, I started Linkin Park with a friend of mine named Mark. In like when we were probably like 19, it was the two of us making little demos. I had like a drum machine and a sampler. He had a guitar and a little amp that was this big. And no bass. We rented a bass, or we just played it on keyboard. No drums. I just programmed those. That was Zero, which became Hybrid Theory, which became Linkin Park. And growing up from those stages to being like on a stage in front of people, you make up your like, you invent the way you do things in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. Like you come into experiments that go well and you go, oh, that went well, I should do that again. And then once you do it a bunch of times, you inevitably end up at, this is the way I do things.
Yeah, I get that for sure. I was going to ask you, and you kind of answered it, but I want to kind of go back to that because you have spent so much time with other artists in the studio. And a lot of these cases, you've kind of mentored them. They're younger artists.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you'll also learn so much from them because the way the landscape is now is a completely different day than when you were first coming on.
Yeah. I think there's some things about like the shape of a day of songwriting that was I learned a lot about how other people approach starting a song from scratch, especially people that do it, that's their primary job. Mm-hmm. So if you think about like Linkin Park, we always wrote our own stuff, played our own stuff, and I learned to produce our stuff. Initially with Don Gilmore. And then I actually, at the end of that period, I found out that I was producing. I didn't even know I was producing. Right. I found out I was producing. And then we worked with Rick Rubin. And Rick was the one who said, yeah, you're the producer in the band. And I went, I'm what? And then it was like, once I got that concept in my head, I went, okay, I have to get better at this then better at the task of producing. So I learned as much as I could. Once I learned that there were people that specialized in like little pieces of the process. Like I learned that there are people out there that just produce vocals.
Right.
They don't produce the song. They don't write the vocals. They just sit, they record you and they get the best, they get the best performance out of you. And then they take that home with them and they make it sound great. And that can be, that means a lot of different things. But to know that somebody specializes in something so specific made me question, well, like, am I good at vocal production? Like, I don't know. I've never spent 2 weeks perfecting a person's vocal. But once I like dissected it a bit, I was like, that's actually something I really love to do. And I think I do it really well. It's just been part of my process that I didn't isolate in my mind.
Well, because you guys were literally DIY creating something from nothing and doing it all autonomously.
Yeah.
You had to assume position and become good at things simply because you didn't have access or you didn't even realize you were producing. I love that Rick Rubin's like, by the way, you're a producer.
We were just being a band. We were just doing things. And we knew that I think we all knew. There were things that people think of when they think of a band that we didn't do as well. So like people think of like, I found out at some point that Rage Against the Machine did their first album. Like they basically came in and like knocked it out in a week or two.
Yeah.
Like just sat in a room and like and all the mics played, were on, they just played.
Right? Yes.
We have never been good at that. We suck at that. Like Linkin Park was always much more of it was almost more of a hip hop approach or like a modern alternative kind of approach where we would write into the computer and use the computer to structure and finish the song. And continue to add more parts, continue to edit, continue to add. It would never be even two people doing like recording and writing at once. It'd be like, I have an idea for a part. Here, let's put it in the song.
I think that's what was so unique and groundbreaking about the band and the timing of it, because you came from more of a hip hop background. Like rewinding for a second, isn't that really what you were raised on? Isn't that what you listened to?
Yeah. I mean, so my parents listened to, God, what would you even call it? Like soft rock or something? Like they listened to, it was like, there'd be like orchestral, like instrumentals or like very chill and cheesy, like ballads and crap like that.
Like what kind? What artists?
Was the station called K-Earth? Did you ever hear about that?
I don't know. Is it like Yacht Rock?
I vaguely remember. So Yacht Rock would be too much energy. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
okay,
this stuff
was so
sleepy. And it
Yacht Rock's too hard.
All love songs. Every single song was a corny love song.
Okay.
My dad, actually, shout out to my dad. This is something people probably don't know. He's like this Japanese man. He's a first generation born in the U.S., so he's Nisei. And he loved reggae.
That's the one weird thing
that he listened to was Bob Marley.
But who doesn't love Bob Marley?
I mean, I think that's right.
Like, but, I don't know one person who doesn't like reggae.
My mom wouldn't put Bob Marley on, is the point. She'd put on that sleepy other stuff.
I see.
By the way, when she was young, she liked the Beatles and Elvis and whatever. She was young, she liked young people music for her generation, right? But as she got older, she just like it was on in the background. She wasn't
her love songs.
In the context of all of this, I heard License to Ill by the Beastie Boys, and I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
This is incredible. And I went down the path of like, I went down all the Def Jam records and all that hip hop that was happening at the time. And then I was like, oh, wait, this Beastie Boys song samples Led Zeppelin, samples the ocean. This Beastie Boys song samples Jimi Hendrix. And other rap songs too. I was finding out like what they sampled, and I loved the sound of those things. So I went deep. I think I went deep on like what would have been called at the time classic rock. Even back then, they called it classic rock. Before I listened to anything that was modern rock.
So I love that your introduction to rock was through hip hop sampling.
Yeah.
That's sick.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And by the way, it was going back to Rick Rubin. A lot of it was guys like Rick who came from they listened to a lot of rock and metal, and then they started like finding ways to implement it or integrate it into the rap stuff they were making.
Yeah. When you finally got to work with Rick on your own music, was that a weird full circle moment for you that you grew up listening to his records that he produced, and then you're actually working with him on your own music?
Like a lot of my favorite records of all time. Like I don't have like a stock list of what they are, but I would say that when we started working with Rick, if I were to write out a top 10, his records would probably sit in five of those spaces.
Wow. Yeah.
Right.
Like understandable. Yeah.
The Beastie Boys and Run DMC stuff, Public Enemy, and then even into like Slayer and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that what he was doing on the Chili Peppers records was incredible. Like he had so many albums that I just loved. And it took me, it took me a while. It took me definitely weeks, maybe even months to like really get comfortable working with him.
I bet.
It was fun. Like I was playing it cool, right?
But you're still a little out of body.
Inside.
I get
I'm kind of like freaking out that I'm working with Rick. Yeah.
Besides learning that you were a producer from Rick, what else did he teach you or did you learn from working with him?
That was one of the great things about working with him was that it was not just about the music. Like it was about life and it was about like being an artist, like in general, the fundamentals of like, well, what's important to you? Why do you get up in the morning and obsess over this? Have you thought about that?
Wow.
Like, and you know, and also like, how do you cultivate your like artistic spirit in a way that not only like gives you the best foundation to make good stuff, but also to be happy and be healthy. I've met artists since that I realize like, oh, a lot of their driving, the things that drive them are out of control. So like, I've met people who are like, they're doing it because they want to be famous. That's an easy one, or want money. Other people are doing it because they've got like issues from the past that they're trying to reconcile, and they're doing it through their music to try and like, they aren't addressing the issues.
Yeah.
And it's coming out in the music, and the music's like helping them with it. Right. That's usually, to me, that's usually positive. But there's other people that do it in a way where it's like, You ever met, I'm sure you've met people who they make a song on a drug.
Yeah.
And then they think they have to make every song on that drug.
Yes. Yes.
Because they're like, but I made 20 songs. They didn't do well, but the one song I did on this, like it did well. So now I got to do every song on it. And you're like, I see why that seems logical to you.
Yes.
I think that's probably not your best plan. Yeah.
Right.
Probably not the best plan.
Not the best plan.
Yeah. It's always like the slightly older artists who are like, I tried that and it really didn't end well.
Yeah. Been there.
And it's strange to me that I did that because every artist I watched growing up did the same thing.
Yes, exactly.
And it didn't end well. It was a bad idea.
When you were in school forming...
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Zero. Tell me about that process of forming the band. And also, sort of side note, did you know Incubus? Because I feel like you guys were at neighboring high schools.
I'm just going to tell you off the bat, I'm going to do my very best, since it's you that I'm talking to, I'm going to do my very best to give you either like more rare pieces of information, or because these stories... I feel bad sometimes for a Linkin Park fan who listens to these interviews, because it's like, I've been doing it for so long. I've told all the stories. Like, they know all this. They can tell the stories for me. So with that said, I'm glad you said the Incubus thing, because that's a weird...
That is a weird
one. It's a weird, like, detail to the almost like the environment that we were growing up in here in the San Fernando Valley and all that. So if you're not familiar with LA, like the north side, there's like a hill where there's like Beverly Hills, and then there's this big like this like hill, like almost like a mountain. And on the other side, there's the San Fernando Valley, and it stretches all the way from Pasadena. In my definition, it stretches all the way from Pasadena up to like past Calabasas and Simi Valley and all that. And we were up towards that side where it was Agoura Hills, Westlake, and Calabasas. And at the time, Calabasas wasn't like Drake and Kanye. Calabasas was like cookie cutter homes with like middle class people who were doing fine. They were doing well, you know, it was starting to become upper middle class. But you'd see like, you know, 10 people pick up their family in like an affordable Lexus. And you're like, damn, like, look at all. Wow. When I moved there, I was like, look at all these. We call them Lexi. Look at all the Lexi, because there were so many of them.
Right,
like,
right.
Damn, these people got money. And we were like driving like a Honda. I'm like, damn, someday we're going to have a Lexus. When I was in, I think it was probably like sophomore or junior year of high school, I heard about Incubus. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this band is like doing really well. And they're from here. Like, they got signed. I think they got signed to Immortal Records. I don't know if they had been signed before that. And they're making an album. And then it came out and it was on the radio locally. And actually some of the guys, I forget how it worked. Were they like a brother in Hoobastank or like a, oh no, it was Audioslave. Not Audioslave, Audio something or other. There were three bands all happening around the same time as us, three other bands. And it was Incubus, who was already like signed and putting out stuff. Hoobastank, who was on their way. And then there was the brothers of Incubus, whose band name I'm forgetting right now, but somebody will comment it. And everybody was like, you could see each other at house parties. Like, I went
That's
to a
great.
House party where I think Mikey from Incubus showed up. I think maybe one of the other guys did. Hoobastank played on a...
What year is this now?
90... I'm going to say four. Summer of
it's
94.
So good.
Might be summer of 94.
Such a great time for music.
Incubus would have been too big to play somebody's backyard.
Right.
It was my friend's backyard, by the way. It wasn't like some random. It was like my friend, and they had a pool, and there was concrete by the pool, and they set up in the concrete. And you want to know how different of a time it was. Incubus covered Ministry at the show. It wasn't like soft, like alternative ballads.
Totally.
They were playing Ministry. This is like heavy industrial. And I was like, damn, he's like that guitar. He's really fast.
Yeah.
And we were going to the Roxy and Whiskey and all that to see all of these bands. And then we found out, oh, there's this band System of a Down is coming out too. And they're from Glendale. And I think they got signed to Rick Rubin and blah, blah, blah. Like it was, that was the scene.
That's pretty awesome.
That was happening up and down the valley.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Also interesting that both you and Incubus have a DJ. You know, that also is another parallel.
That was another thing that it was like. So to put that in context, I think that like people who were critical of that time, like whenever a bit of a trend starts to happen, you start to see multiple bands or groups or artists doing the same or similar things. People get kind of like raise their eyebrows at it, as they should. I remember for me, I didn't love rock bands, modern rock bands at the time, until I started to see them incorporating hip hop. Like my friend Mark, who I started Zero with, Mark played me Rage Against the Machine. He's like, I heard this new band. You're going to like this. The dude doesn't sing at all. He only raps.
Yeah.
And I was like, let me hear it. And I loved it. And then it was like, I got into, I found out about some more bands that had some of that in it, from, you know, Chili Peppers to, there's a soundtrack called Judgment Night.
One of the greatest.
Totally underrated for how influential it was. The opening track was by Helmet and House of Pain.
Yes.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Such a good song. And then, I remembered like, when I started to hear groups like Korn and Limp Bizkit and Deftones and others start to bring in pieces of it, but be very, I thought with Korn and Deftones in particular, I was like, wow, they're doing something they're taking a lot of risks.
Yes.
Like they're doing it so different. And I liked the idea of, oh, this is like, it reminded me of when rap was very open. This is a weird connection to make, but there was a time when you might have like a gangster rap group and a hippie rap group and other types of things doing way, like the difference between NWA and then later De La Soul was really dramatic. Such a huge difference. Yeah. And I was starting to feel like, oh, this is happening in rock. Like I know what this is and I like this. And it means that the like playing field is really open for us. So we can start to integrate our version of what this mixture means. And so that's how we really started to focus in on like the sound of our band.
That's incredible. Was there a moment when you're like, okay, we got our sound? Because it wasn't easy for you guys. Didn't you guys showcase like 50 times? Like, wasn't it difficult to get that first opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's before we met Chester, Mark was our singer. We showcased for every major and every independent label, and they effectively passed. And then we parted ways with Mark. He was having a hard time being a singer. He loved music. He was good at writing. He was much better at managing, it turned out. And that's what he ended up doing. He actually manages a bunch of the bands that we were talking about. And has done very well doing that. And then we found Chester. And when we first met Chester, he hadn't really, it took us a minute to like really click. I think we were just all like green and like a little nervous. And to be honest, like a few of us, myself included, like we take a while to warm up to people.
Right.
Just how I am.
Plus, he was the outsider because all of you had known
each
other.
He was very different. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know Phoenix, our bass player, super well. I knew Rob okay. I knew Joe and Brad well. And then, when Chester came in the band, he was very he was a chameleon. Like he was a very good singer, but he could sing in a lot of different styles. And one minute he'd be singing like Dave Gahan from Depeche Mode. And the next minute he was doing like a Perry Farrell thing. And the next minute it was something else. Like you could literally call out a singer and he'd adjust to sound more like them. And so the goal was in the beginning, and this is where if I had known it was called producing, I would know that's what I was doing, but I didn't know. I was just figuring it out with him as we went.
Yeah.
Which is, hey, dude, like right now we're still figuring out our signature everything. Like, what's our signature sound as a band? What's your signature sound as a vocalist? And so I love the thing you did on this song. Let's make this other song a little more like that, because that feels like you.
Aww.
When you sing it the other way, it feels more like you're trying to be this person that we both love.
Yes.
We love their music.
But we need our own sound.
They've already drawn a fence around that territory. Like, that's not, we can't live over there. We got to live in our own house.
It was a process. Was there a moment where like, oh my God, we have our own thing?
There were probably moments that were like, you know, landmark, like jumps forward in that way. But I don't think of the, I can't think of them. Like, I always think of it as more of a slow, like coming into focus.
Came into it, right. Yeah. Speaking of soundtracks, the first time I ever heard Linkin Park was actually on the Dracula 2000 soundtrack.
I'm so sorry. Jesus.
I was a Sony.
I was hoping it was going to be like, you know, this really, I went to a show and you guys crushed.
I'll tell you why.
That would be so ideal.
I'll tell you why. I lived in New York. I'm a New Yorker.
Okay.
So I was not part of this scene at all. I was in New York and I was a Sony college rep, and Dracula 2000 soundtrack was one of the Sony priorities.
Yeah.
And on it was like System of a Down, Saliva, you know, Marilyn Manson. And One Step Closer was on it.
Mm.
And I will never forget. I had the CD in my car. In my CD player.
Yeah.
And that came on and I literally pulled over and I was like, what is
this?
That's
cool. Okay, that is
cool. One Step Closer stood out from all the other songs on that soundtrack. Mm. And that's when I became obsessed. And specifically, the Shut Up in the bridge, which I think how did that come about? Because I think we talked about that before.
We had written the riff. So Brad wrote the riff when we were just like hanging out and we were shooting some pictures that we were going to put on, like use on something of ours. But it was like our friend, like with his little snapshot cameras in like Joe's apartment's garage. Okay. So it wasn't at some fan, like we were nobody. And Brad was doodling this like little thing. And I remember him sitting in, he had a Honda Accord and he was in the passenger side back seat, just sitting with the door open. And he's like, what do you think of this? I was like, dude, that's incredible. Like, he had a little recorder and I was like, put it on, make sure you don't lose that. Put it on your little recorder. And then we came back to it. So he wrote the main riff and then I wrote the chorus riff based on his riff. And then I think I wrote the bridge riff, but I can't remember if we wrote that together. So there's a possibility it's one or the other. And I did the like tracking of like the sketch out of like, okay, this is how the drums will go. This is how the bass will go, and taught it to the other guys and so on. So fast forward to like being in the studio working on this thing. I remembered like we started working with Don Gilmore and we got this rapport with him where he was comfortable enough to like send us back to the drawing board on things and we wouldn't like freak out. And that was a song where he was like, the track is the best thing about it. Like, keep working on it. And we got really frustrated. Like, he kept sending us back and he was focused on something else. So he's being very dismissive and we were getting pissed. And so the lyrics of it are very reactive to how
I say,
like, he was being like a rude, like, it was like there was rudeness in our minds to it. It's just like, fuck that guy. And by the time we nailed the verse and the chorus, he was like, yeah, I think that's right. But, you know, what are you going to do in that big part, the bridge? And I remembered sitting in the lounge where we were writing, just separate from the area where they were recording something else. And Chester and I were in the lounge trying to figure this out. And I said to him, what do you think about just saying shut up? And he's like, he was like just saying it? I was like, no, you like scream it. But like, yeah, just that, like nothing bigger. I was like, you know that Rage Against the Machine song where he's like, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me?
Yeah.
Like that. And he's like, oh, like that is, that's going to be great. Like he was like, I'm pumped.
That's
Let's
a
do
great
that.
Reference. So was it that Rage part that inspired that?
It was
that
Rage
that?
Part. I was like, Rage part is so iconic.
So iconic.
And like, anthemic. I want to do something like that. Like when we play it at the Roxy,
yes,
people are going to fucking tear the, yes, place apart. And he was like, that's the part. And he knew, we both knew immediately that that was the best part of the song. It was going to be incredible.
Yeah.
And he had never even, he was screaming on other stuff, but he hadn't done it on that song yet. We told Don, we walked in, we were like, wrap it up. Like what, this guitar thing you guys are doing, like, stop.
Like, get ready for this.
Get,
yes,
the mic up. Like, yeah, you got to hear this thing. And he's like, like he was like still so focused,
yeah,
and he did what we said and we put Chester on the mic, and on the very first take I don't know if we kept the very first take, but the very first take was exactly what you feel when you hear the song. And Don like freaked out. He, yeah, was running around the room. He's like, oh my god, like everybody knew it was like special.
I have chills.
It was
shut up when I'm talking, yeah, to you.
It was incredible.
I mean, even on my way here, I put it on the car and here I am doing it. Like literally, that's your Rage Against the Machine moment. And that was,
yeah,
really,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
that's what got me.
Yeah, yeah,
I,
yeah,
think that's what made me pull my car over.
I loved that. I loved the way they did that. And by the way, there were other bands, like I know, like we referenced Deftones and Korn and a lot of other bands that at the time were, had come out, you know, after Rage. And there was, yeah, I feel like there was a lot of really good references for that type of thing, but we wanted to do, I felt like the shut up thing was, actually, have I said this before? My mom, like, shut up was a bad word in our house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was like, there's the words you can say and the words, yeah, you're not allowed to say. And right on the other side of that line was shut up. And we were like, really? Like, shut up is like a bad word. She's like, I don't want to hear it in my house. So in my house, you weren't allowed to say that, you get yelled at if you said that. And so, of course, that
made
it.
This was defiance.
When my, yeah, mom heard that song for the first time, that was her joke. Immediate. She's like, of course, this is,
yes,
the bridge of your first song.
Like, of course.
Of course, that's what you do.
Oh, my God. I love that backstory. It was such an exciting time, the late 90s, though. I think you're right. I think Rage was one of the pioneers kind of it. But then it really, oh, became this movement. It really, yeah, was. It was called nu metal or whatever you, yeah, want to call it. What was the vibe like at the time? Was there a community? Was it competitive? Were you friends with these other bands?
It was all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd find, like, we found little friendships with different people. Sometimes we get along with specific people in bands. I know we did a bunch of tours with Taproot.
Yes.
We did, you know, we spent some time with Deftones. In the beginning, I think in the beginning with them, it was very competitive. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, and that wasn't like our intention. That wasn't our fault. It's just that One Step Closer came out and it,
yeah,
did really, really well right off the bat. And we were opening for them and they were like, who the hell are these new kids? Like, effectively, their attitude was like, who are these new kids beating us at radio?
And then it just kept going with more
and
songs.
And we're the headliners.
Songs, right?
Right?
And that was just the beginning.
I felt, and Chino and I have talked about that since. Like, we're definitely very cool. He's incredible. He's,
yeah,
such
he's
a
amazing.
Good dude.
Yeah.
And by the way, he has, like, the best taste. That was, like, one of the things that I always thought was so cool about them is that they, the things that he listened to and, like, always talked about, he was such like a tastemaker in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like he'd talk longer about Sade than he would about like Slayer, right?
And that's cool.
Yeah, and that was something that I thought I related to because that's how we talked about music.
So many different influences and new and very knowledgeable about
when
them.
When we, yeah, when people asked us what's Linkin Park sound like, what's your band sound like, we tell them the Roots, Portishead, Deftones, and Aphex Twin.
That's fantastic.
And they were like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Right.
That's like, doesn't make any sense at all. We're like, well, do you know who those bands are? And they'd be like, no.
But that's why you made such a mark. And the fact that in the Hybrid Theory, it was not just One Step Closer. It was so many songs. Mm. And of course, in the end, I mean, to this day, I think that's your most streamed song.
Yeah, it's one of, it's always, like one of, always like one of.
So yeah.
I think it's top though, yeah.
I think that's the top. It's like, and at the time, of course, you would have no idea that it would have reached that magnitude. But did you set out to do it? Did you set out to say, we are going to have our own sound and we are going to change history? I mean, it's crazy what you guys accomplished with that album.
Yeah, no, we wouldn't have been so bold to say that. But I think our goal was like, so we did have a lot of different goals. Maybe this is good, like for like, if you're young, I tell young artists, if I speak to like a college class or if I'm in a studio with somebody, like one thing that we did, I want to say we did this, we've always done this, I've always done this, is I don't really consider something to be part of an album unless I would be comfortable with it being a single or the label getting behind it or people hearing it and getting behind it. I've seen way too many groups and artists put out songs because other people told them that it was a hit and they don't love the song. They're just like, well, I just want my career to do well. Yeah. Like I want to pay the bills. So like if they say this is a hit, if they say we need to put so-and-so as a feature on it, letting people to make all those other decisions. I understand when it's like sometimes those things are very convincing and you want to experiment, right? Yeah. Like you want to take a risk and do something that's outside of your comfort zone. That's fine. Like I don't ever knock somebody for that because I've done the same thing. But there are definitely moments when you go, somebody says, we think you should do this. And your gut reaction is that is a bad idea. I don't like it. And then you go along with it anyway because of some external reason and you regret it later.
That's really good advice. Yeah.
We didn't do that on Hybrid. I want to say we haven't done that on any of our records. There may have been like subtle places where one of the guys in the band would say like, I think we wiggled. Like, I think we didn't all agree on a thing. And so it wiggled its way into the album somehow. But certainly there's no place on any of our records. And I can say this with like pretty confidently. There's no place on any of our records as Linkin Park or solo where I fundamentally did not like something and it's on the record.
Okay.
Like, I don't give a shit if the like radio department says it's the biggest thing in the world. Like, if I don't like it, it's not going there.
That's great. That's...
And they probably wouldn't have heard it. If I don't like it, I probably would have never played it.
Brought it to them. Right. Yeah. Exactly. When Hybrid Theory took off, your lives changed forever. It was meteoric, sort of pun intended right there.
Yeah.
But how did you handle it? I mean, was it exciting? Was it overwhelming? It was also a weird time because the landscape started to change from rock to pop with boy bands and all the, you know, the juxtaposition of like huge rock movement, but also pop. And you were both equally popular. That's sort of unique to that time.
It
was like the last time.
There hasn't been a time since where rock has been as big as it
exactly
was.
Exactly right.
At the same time, pop was like, and by pop, I mean like, aggressively pop,
yes,
like shiny and safe and engineered to be an earworm. Pop was like having a huge moment. There wasn't anything like when I hear pop stuff these days, it's much more integrated and like it's much more tasteful, to be honest, than the stuff that I was hearing back then.
Right.
And there were also limited channels.
Yeah.
There were tastemakers who were breaking things and meaning they were making them popular. TRL existed.
Yeah.
Right. So I watched TRL. I avoided TRL. And when I did see it, I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, these kids are these screaming, frenetic fanaticism is creepy to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that it's like the most important thing, but meaning it would, if you get on it, you will win. Like you're going to be popular the moment that you're on this show. And then I started to see groups that I liked go on it. And I was like, oh my God, like, okay, so hold on a second. Like, this show can like has room for these other things. And the people are just as excited to see Jay-Z as they are to see Britney Spears. Like, I gotta wrap my head around that. And we ended up getting invited to go to the show. And I just kind of like went along for the experience. I will tell you, I've never heard something so loud. The format of the show was, you know, dozens and dozens of people placed immediately next to you, screaming as loud as they can to, like, you know, violently express their fanaticism about everything that's happening. And then you've got a host who's literally talking like this, and he's got an earpiece, and they're screaming as loud as they can,
That's wild.
It was surreal. It didn't feel like a real thing.
I'm like, even just taking the songs, I'm picturing myself there, and that's just wild.
There's never been anything like it.
It's sort of the point of no return. It's like once you've experienced that, and then you guys even catapulted even further into the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of that album cycle, as we were getting into writing Meteora, they management told us that we had the biggest album on the planet.
Yeah,
that year, and that didn't sound like a real thing. It didn't sound like a real, like, piece of information. And as we digested it, just because there were so many other things that seemed like they were so big that we couldn't. We knew our thing. We knew Hybrid Theory and our tour and all those things had done well. But we couldn't, I personally couldn't imagine us being on the same level as like a Britney Spears and all of the, like, I don't remember if it was exactly like NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and all that, but all that stuff was really big.
I was grateful for you guys because I did not like any of that pop stuff at all.
I was not a fan.
At all.
Yeah.
And I was grateful that you guys were holding it down. And
I will say, actually, just to say it, like, to I don't know that I've ever like directly addressed that weird moment, because we were trying, not only we were in all of the same conversations as all those groups. So I don't even know what the modern like equivalent would be, but we were there trying to hold on to some shred of credibility,
right,
and integrity. Not from just, I mean, including what people think of us, but what we think of ourselves. And to show up at an award show and be mentioned in the same breath as all of these what we considered to be manufactured pop acts, it brought questions about our, like, was the Linkin Park manufactured by somebody and whatever. We're like, we built this. Like,
ourselves.
Yeah.
From scratch.
Like, they had... expensive and like tested songwriters and producers. Like, if you played a guitar on that record, like, you were in sessions every day for decades.
Like, best ever.
Everybody was like, it was math and it was lots of money, and they assembled these great things and they won. And we made it ourselves and managed to stand on the same podium with them. And we were very insecure about it. And so, because also there were these rumors going around that it was fake, and we knew that was not, we knew that it wasn't fake, but we had to like address it. And so we'd go to this, like, for example, an award show, and one of those groups would get an award, and we were just like so insecure. We'd just sit, people are like standing up, clapping, and we'd just sit there because we didn't want a single picture of us taken celebrating that thing as if we were in the same category. Yeah, right.
I totally get that.
It was so I say that as like almost like I say that as sincerely an apology to those people, because it's not their fault.
Right,
like, they were just doing their thing.
Right.
And I watched an episode of watched this episode of Hot Ones with NSYNC the other day.
Okay.
That just came out recently. And there was a lot of moments in it where it was like taking me back to that time period. And I'm like, these are nice boys. Like, these are likable guys.
They're lovely lads.
They're not demons.
No,
they're not industry puppets. They're just singers trying to do their thing.
It's just that when you lived through that time and you were literally the artist, I was the fan, there was this juxtaposition of holding on to the credible, autonomous art. There was music and there was music product, and they are both enjoyable in different ways. But for those of us who love the dirt and the edginess and the authenticity, we saw it vanishing out of the mainstream. So you guys were really holding it down. You played a huge role. And then we went into the 2000s and it was even harder and harder. But like that, there was this juxtaposition at that time. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huge juxtaposition.
I remember when for a long time, like if when I was in high school, I could love a band and then I'd see their patch on somebody's backpack or their sticker
the
on
patch.
Somebody's thing.
Yeah.
And it was somebody that it was like some like vapid cheerleader, like just like who I remember seeing this girl with a Green Day patch on her backpack. And I was like, number one, she knows one song. Number two, I hate Green Day now. Like, sorry, Green Day, but like she's ruining it.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to the show and see her there. I can't stand her. And as a function of like, I don't know, the way this culture works, I'm not going to listen to you anymore.
Yeah.
Not Green Day's fault. We ended up in that position, right? Like where it's like, oh, okay. So now there are literally like people that I wouldn't hang out with at our shows. And I'm going, is that fair of me to do that? Like, that's not cool. Like, there's nothing wrong with being a cheerleader. There's nothing wrong with being into like, you know, these other pop groups and whatever. Like, it's just different people. And then it expanded way beyond that to like, oh, now I'm in.
It was pop culture.
Well, we started traveling overseas. So then you're in an entire country of people that are unfamiliar with culture that's unfamiliar. I remember when we played Malaysia for the first time, and this is a Muslim country that we look out in the crowd and there are like 14, 15, 16 year old tons of kids, and all of the girls have a hijab. They're like really hype, but there's like certain things they don't culturally do. We learned that you can't show the bottoms of your feet to people in certain countries because it's like giving them the middle finger.
Wow.
So they're like, when you're sitting in an interview or if you're playing on stage and you walk up on this thing, like when you do it, try not to jump and put your feet out, because if they get a picture of you putting your feet out at people, it looks
disrespectful.
It looks disrespectful. And we're like, oh my God, the world is such a bigger place than we imagine. Mm-hmm. Like there's this awesome commonality and there's all this stuff you don't know. And we got it, you know, like we ran the gauntlet with it. We had to experience it very quickly and adapt very quickly.
You guys catapulted into this global superstardom. Was there difficulties that came with that? How did you all handle that? Or did you love it and you're like, I can't believe we're here?
I mean, the most important thing that happened around that time between like somewhere, you know, around the first three albums was that the guys they're very intentional about checking each other.
That's great.
And also like just being reflective and realizing that our lives had fundamentally changed. And because of that new like place that we were all at, we were getting also starting to get older and looking to get, you know, some of us were starting to get married and like thinking about kids. And this is all happening in the context of this band that's like gone from being something you do on Saturday night at my apartment to like you're headlining every festival anywhere you go. And so it took the culture of the six guys and some of the people around us to like really encourage, like, I think mental health is like such a goofy, it's become such a goofy phrase. It kind of makes me like, I don't know. I know that's a weird thing to say because, but the thing is that when some people start using words like that over and over and over and they, they attribute, like they put a huge, it's mental health becomes a huge basket and all this other stuff falls into it. And some of the things that people put into it are not all that helpful or they don't actually mean very much. It gets frustrating to me when I think about that time and that when we were starting to realize that our lives had fundamentally changed. And I think about mental health. We never would have called it mental health. We never would have had very much definition around the things we were doing to make ourselves, to keep ourselves healthy. We just like did them as a function of community.
Yes.
Like it was like, hey, I feel like, are you tired? Like, I feel like you're like kind of like, should we take it easy tonight? Cause like, I feel like it's been a big week for you. Stuff like when someone, your friend says that and they're like, it's not just like, hey, you should, or I'm no, that's like, I'm going to change my thing that's going on, my schedule to make things easier for you. Cause I feel like you're, cup is kind of empty.
Yeah.
We would do that. Like everybody in the band would do that for each other all the time.
I mean, this advantage of being in a band, I mean, for solo artists who are really alone, you know, and they're doing it all themselves. I had the most fortunate experience when you guys were doing the One More Light album. I got to be in the studio with you guys and to sit with all of you and listen to these new songs and this new direction. And it was one of my favorite experiences. I don't feel like you and I haven't had a chance to talk about it, but it was one of those days that I cherish. It really was so special. And I remember, I loved every song. I loved this new direction. I know it was also a new chapter for you guys. I think it was the first time you had other songwriters as part of the process.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember specifically hearing One More Light and tearing up in the studio with you guys. And then, of course, tragically, that song took on a whole other level after Chester's passing. All of the music does is through a different lens. You know, how does, when you perform these songs, you know, like you recently hopped up on stage with G-Flip in Australia. In Australia, you just performed with all of these players performing the music. How have, what's this process been like for you to be able to perform the music?
Yeah, it depends on the song.
It depends on the song, I'm sure.
It depends on the song. I did on my solo tour, like that was, I think in different points of time, it's been a different like intention. And so for example, jumping on stage with G Flip, that was just, I was just partying with a friend.
Like I
was
that. Just,
G was, I was in Australia. It was their show. And I wanted to, I just wanted to come. I just wanted to watch. And G was like, do you want to jump on stage
for a minute? That's what they said. That's
and
awesome.
I was like, I'm down. Like, what do you want to do though? Because we wrote, I think we've written two things, I think. And neither of them was like, it didn't make the record. Like the songs on their record are better than the song that we wrote. And I loved the single Worst Person Alive.
So good.
And G was like, will you jump up for Worst Person Live? I was like, dude, that's my song.
So
like,
good.
I love that song.
It's so good.
So we that was the plan. And then I think they were like, do you want to do something? Like, could you do like a rap verse or something? And that's how that started the whole, it was just like natural.
Totally.
Can you do something of yours during my song? And I was like, yes. And it became
so
like,
good.
Let's just also tag it into like In the End a little bit. It's funny because that was very celebratory and just organic and we just did what felt good. Back a few years earlier, I had done a tour called Post Traumatic.
Yep.
And that was much more about catharsis and like facing all that scary shit of Chester's passing and everything head on. And so when I did that, when I was in London, I had two of my favorite co-writers from the record live in London, John Green and Egg White. Egg's real name is Francis.
Right.
He goes by Egg White. His friends call him Egg White. His friends call him Egg White in school.
It's a great nickname.
They were available to come sing those songs. And I did, and I had written One More Light with Egg. And so we sang it and it was it's a very different song now. Like when we wrote it, as you know, like when we wrote it, it was about a woman that we knew, that I knew, who had passed away, who worked for the label, who had worked on our stuff. And she's this like super wonderful, sweet person. And like everyone at the label loved her. And she got cancer and she passed away. And Egg was in town for a very short time to write with us. And the funeral was on one of those days. And Brad and I were like, okay, we can't. I was like, I feel we need to have like, we need to respect Egg and we need to respect her. Like what, like, I think he and I had agreed together. You write with Egg, I'll represent us all at the funeral. And so he went there that day and I wrote with Egg that day. And that's why we wrote that song. I was like, it feels stupid to like, I feel bad that I'm not there at the funeral. So like, I feel like I have to.
Yeah.
Like doing this is like my way of being there in a sense.
And honoring her.
And it became, like the name of the album.
Yeah. Yeah. That song. Wow. I remember literally sitting there with you guys tearing up. I mean, it was
rough. Yeah. Yeah. But also like, you know, I think that some of those songs, like I know, I've talked about this before a little bit, but there are some times when I'm writing and I think most experienced songwriters would say a similar thing. There are times when I feel like the song itself is like showing up and it's in the room and it's declaring its presence. Like it becomes easy to write it. The words are obvious when you find them. The melodies are, everything is natural. And it's not that it can be, it doesn't have to be fast. It's just that when you feel it, you know.
Yeah.
I've had that on almost, I think all the songs we've talked about, I had that on In the End. I had that on, I mean, some of the ones we didn't talk about, Breaking the Habit was very much that way. Yeah, definitely One More Light. And those are the times when I realize that some of the process of writing a song is me. And like my skill set and my experience and my craftsmanship and like carefully getting this thing into shape for people to experience and for me to go like, yeah, this is the nucleus. This is the like most, I don't know. I don't want to say perfect, but like, this is the best I can do with this idea.
Mm-hmm.
This is as good as I can get it. And I'm ready for you to experience it and hear it. That's part of the process. The other part of the process is just like magic. It's just in the room. It just doesn't
like
care.
Letting it free.
Yeah. And some people believe that actually, if you don't, that you might start a thing like that and take it as far as it can go, or even fail at bringing it to life. And then that exact same song will go to somebody else and they'll have a better relationship with it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have a more pure or more true.
Well, it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
It's like you present it as your gift.
I don't mean with a fan. I mean another artist. Like I've heard people say, you ever heard people where they like two different artists will come up with the same song at the same time, or like same album name or same movie or all these things happen at the same time. Sometimes that's because of like weird industry crap.
Yeah.
There's some chitter chatter, some people talking when they shouldn't talk. There are times when I've experienced where someone will say to me, I'll play someone a song. And they will say, oh my God, like I was just in a session with somebody else this week. Like you wrote that, you wrote this 3 days ago. I was with somebody 3 days ago, 4 days ago, 2 days ago, whatever. And we had like, check out how similar the idea is.
So interesting.
Just because it's in the ether.
Yeah. Wow.
Maybe it's nothing. I feel like if whether or not that has any bearing on reality, I do think that like, you know, your voice and your relationship with the song is, that connection is special because of the something you can't control.
Yeah.
You can be the best songwriter in the world, but you're not going to force that relationship between you and that song
to
work.
Absolutely. It's like a cosmic connection. It really is.
Like Elton John and, or I guess Bernie Taupin.
Yeah.
And like, or like, Lennon and McCartney had shitty songs, mm-hmm. and they had life-changing songs too, right?
Yeah.
But the shitty ones, it butted heads with an idea that didn't want to work out.
Yeah. Do you think Linkin Park could play again? Like, do you think there could be some sort of iteration, reunion?
Were you thinking that because of, did you see the Elton John Dodger Stadium show?
I wasn't present for it. I didn't attend it, but
I saw it, and there's like a part of me that when I see somebody who's had such a career and like I love so many of their songs and they're still great.
Yeah.
Like when he played that show, I felt like he wasn't missing a beat. Like
yeah.
it just was on fire. And yeah. I've seen other artists who are later in their career and you know, they used to be better.
Yeah.
But they're still doing it, and I'm glad they are. I don't know, with that context, like, I don't know the answers to that for me because I don't feel like I'm there. I'm not at that point where I'm, like, ready to hang it up.
Yeah.
And there are questions to answer in order to figure out what to do next
right.
on that subject. So,
totally.
You know, we'll see.
We'll see. What about you personally? I mean, you are a Grammy Award-winning songwriter, producer, performer, you've had art exhibits, you know,
yeah.
you're a composer, you know, you've done scores. Is there something else that you would love to do that's still ahead of you that it's like on your bucket list?
I have some things. Yeah. I think it, you know, I'm curious. And I like to like kick the tires on things and like, I'm not afraid to like, you know, make some weird creative decisions and in public.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with that. I do love, like, I think in terms of things that I would want to play with, there's a lot of stuff going on with modern technology that opens up, some opportunities to make things that are unusual. I think that's why I have like this relationship with the label that I'm their their community innovation advisor.
Yes.
The CIA. I'm the CIA.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I named it that. But it's true. Like I wanna be in the mix on innovative ideas and creating things that haven't been created or that are different or just, you know, expanding the ways that we can think about the way we do things as musicians. And with that said, like, you know, we were talking, I think a lot of that role has been like, you know, Web3 type mm-hmm. of things. AI is obviously a big part of the picture now. So we'll see what's up with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tricky thing because like, obviously with both of those, but AI in particular, you've got a lot of, there's a lot of places where we're realizing it's actually doing artists a disservice. Yeah. So
yeah.
Learning to be very careful mm-hmm. there. And hopefully artists get a whole bunch of protections that they need from
yes.
folks that can make those decisions. In the meantime though, yeah. This is a very like I think this moment in time for me. I put out this new song, hoping to put out some more new music. And I don't know, I like put a game.
You know, I know. The
game,
I
put a
that.
Game up on my website.
That's so great.
That's like it's like you're like, so the game is you go on and you basically get it's very creepy. It's like a sci-fi horror game.
You're like a critter.
And you get this yeah. critter, you get this character and you've got to grow it. And everyone's starting to realize, oh, these are not like friendly critters. These are all, they're all
it's
like
gremlins.
Weird
yeah.
bloodthirsty little monsters.
Right.
So everybody's getting their own little weird bloodthirsty little monster. And we're working towards some battle mechanics. And, you know, if fans stay interested, we can continue to build it. If
yeah.
they go, okay, that was fun. Like we're done now.
Yeah.
Then we'll move on to the next thing.
It's all good. But you've always sort of been ahead of the curve on all of this kind of stuff. You were early on with Spotify, I remember.
Yeah.
You've always been
yeah.
ahead of this.
I was an advisor when Spotify came to the US. That was actually really cool because I got a peek under the hood of a very big cultural shift before it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I got to like meet with Daniel, the founder of Spotify,
yes,
who
of course.
As he was like starting, they had had a pretty good success in Europe and they were about to bring it to the US for the first time. And we were having meetings about like how to do that and whatever. And they were running these like ideas by me, but more, I didn't have any, like, it wasn't, for me, it was just like watching this cool thing unfold and seeing what I could learn from it.
And I think what's so crazy is that I think it's true that Linkin Park is the most streamed alternative rock band or something. There's some sort of like crazy statistic.
Maybe so. I hear like stuff like that and I go, maybe it's true. I have no idea.
But it's pretty cool. I think you were the first band to hit 1 billion views on YouTube. You know, it's like all these wild statistics.
I think that one's definitely true. Right? Like, there's also like the Amazing Orange or something, like some random meme, some like meme account. Totally. He's like, Linkin Park got to 1 billion. We're at like 700 billion now. Exactly. So like, fine.
Right.
That's not first a real band. Number, but.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah. All right. Let's do deep cuts.
Deep cuts.
Okay. Name a song, album, or artist that changed your life.
Public Enemy, Nation of Millions. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one. I mean,
there was nothing that sounded like. I go back to it now and I think like what people must have thought this was the most abrasive.
Yes.
Like if I was like working at a label and somebody played me Public Enemy at the time, I would have been like, there's everything going on here sounds like a reason that it won't work.
Yeah.
Like you've got super political lyrics. You've got this like alarm sound, repetition, noise in the music. Yeah. The music is just like chaos. It's got like metal references. They're vocally anti-mainstream. And then you got Flavor Flav like making a joke out of everything. Like, how's that? Doesn't that diffuse all the seriousness of Chuck D's like political? He's like telling you all these important things and the other guy's making jokes about like, I don't know what.
And that's how it somehow became, it was perfect.
I loved everything
about
it.
It was so good.
I saw them live at the time and I was like, this is like that's the greatest. Yeah, it was like such a formative experience.
So good. What was your first concert?
Anthrax and Public Enemy with Primus and Young Black Teenagers.
Okay, that wins. Yeah. That's your first concert. It's amazing.
Very first concert.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
With my friend Mark that I started the band with. Yeah.
That's so good. Do you have a t-shirt from this concert? Because that would really be amazing.
I did. I don't know what happened to it. Yeah.
You need to get that back.
I know.
What is a song you wish you wrote?
You know what? Song is just like, it hits me as like so pitch perfect in terms of it's bigger than itself. Like it's written just right. It's recorded just right. But its place in the world right now is so special is One More Time by Blink.
Oh yeah.
Such an incredible, like they summed up this moment in their careers perfectly in a song. And that's hard. It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought I heard that and I was like, well done guys. Like you nailed it.
Well, when we were talking about TRL earlier, you, both of you guys were on it sort of at the same time.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with Blink then?
I just liked them. Yeah. I didn't think, We actually weren't running in the same circles very much.
Okay.
Because they were, because of the punk thing and because of like, they leaned so heavy into like making you laugh.
Yeah.
And our aesthetic was much more serious, at least on records, at the shows and on the albums. So yeah, we didn't, you know, also I have to imagine like we were probably both headlining festivals. So if we played on a Saturday night, they played it on a Friday night and they were gone by the time we got there.
That's interesting. Yeah. You were never together. Yeah. That makes sense.
We met much later on and I love those guys. I haven't really hung out with Tom very much. But yeah, Travis and Mark, I've hung with a few times and like Mark is the kind of guy that like, he's so humble.
Yeah.
People say that about people, but Mark's humble to a point where I like worry about him. I'm like, why are you so self-deprecating? And like, he literally doesn't believe it's beyond like imposter syndrome at a certain point where like, he like literally doesn't believe how great he is at certain things. I'm like, you're incredible.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get it. It's like the Japanese part of me is like feels like that's so familiar.
Yes.
Like that's very culturally, it's yeah. very familiar.
Yeah. They're special guys.
Yeah.
They really are. Yeah. What is something your fans would be surprised to learn about you?
Surprise. I don't think there are any surprises at this point. Are there? I don't know. What did we, maybe there's something we did this. I tried to make cake pops with one of my kids this week.
I was going to say something with your kids. Something
I tried
with your
to make
kids.
Cake pops this week. And
it was challenging.
Cake pops are way harder than you think. They sucked. I yeah. mean, they tasted fine, but they
right.
look
the
like.
The presentation is difficult to achieve.
Dude.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot more of YouTube research to get a cake pop right. I'll tell you that.
What do you hope your kids learn from you?
We're big on gratitude.
Yeah.
At our house. We're big on letting the kids explore stuff that they're interested in. I mean, my parents were always very cool. I didn't have the parents that were like, you can't do that, or that's not, you know, art isn't a real job type of parents. And that was, I thought that was a really good thing. I'm hoping that I try to maintain some level of that in our, with our kids. But yeah, they, you know, for anybody who has kids, you know, that they're like, there are things that you struggle with as a parent or that they struggle with as a person that aren't, they don't like come from anywhere. They're just like born with it. Like they're just like they're born with a sense of humor. They're also yeah. can be born with like a lot of anxiety
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or like, you know, I mean, not to mention all the other things that you might have to get medication for. but like, yeah, it's like those things are the struggles that you go through where you, you know, especially when you ever heard that thing about, I'm going to say it poorly, but you get faced with the same problem until you learn how to solve it.
Yes.
Yeah. So like stuff that you know you're not good at or that you struggled with as a kid or that like is like, I don't know, you've got issues with the way you were raised and it was a problem then and you haven't figured it out and now it's showing up with the kids. Like all that stuff is probably the biggest challenge to me.
Yeah.
Being a parent is being faced with those things. And you gotta just, I mean, we just realized, Anna and I have just realized like, we're definitely not perfect. We're definitely doing our best.
That's all you can do.
You can, yeah. That's the job.
That's all you can do.
Yeah.
And gratitude is key. I'm glad to hear
gratitude
that. We're the same in our
every
house
single
too.
Every single day.
Every day. We that's do the key
that,
to happiness.
That's the question. We do that before bedtime every night.
Oh,
that's the question every night is what are you grateful for
that's beautiful.
Today? And on crappy days, it's a hard one to answer.
Yes, of course. That's right. Something we should all ask ourselves.
Oh my God.
For our own sanity.
For a little kid to tell you why they're grateful when they're like, they and their friends are all in a huge fight.
Aww.
They're just like, nothing. I'm not grateful for yeah. anything. This sucks. You're just like, I hear that and I respect
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I would like you to try anyway.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. What are words you live by?
What? There's a, like a fan meme of me saying this thing that I don't even remember saying about something about be kind and work hard and don't be an asshole or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't remember what it was. I just said it at one point and it became like in our little fan community,
aww.
Like it's my face with that quote. And I'm kind of glad that's the quote
yeah.
they pulled out. I mean, I don't think my mom would be happy that it's asshole, but yeah, the kind part actually to focus in on one piece of it, the older I've gotten, I've realized that that being kind, everyone just thinks that is being kind to other people, but you got to be kind to yourself
yes.
too. Like it's hard, like some, I, a lot of us beat ourselves up over dumb stuff and, identifying when you're doing that and easing back
yeah.
as an act of kindness to yourself is like a hard thing to do, but it's a good thing to do.
It's essential.
Yeah, I think
so. When you're kind to yourself, you can actually be kinder to others.
I just saw a clip of Mr. Rogers saying that. Did
really?
You know? I literally
no.
just saw it.
Oh.
Yeah. He said this whole thing about like, you know, I know you want to be kind to other people. That's what you want. But in order to get there, sometimes you have to deal with being kind to yourself first, or else you won't have anything left over to be kind to the other people. So if you're the type of person, like, it was always neat because the way he did it, with like the strategic way that he structured it, was almost like, well, I know you want to be kind to them. So as a function of like doing that, be kind to yourself.
Well, I always wanted to be Mr. Rogers, so I guess works out.
I feel like he was a genius.
Genius.
Total genius.
Trailblazer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful human being.
Yeah, for sure.
Mike, thank you. This was really a treat.
We're going to end on Mr. Rogers.
We're going to end Mr. Rogers.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's what we do here. Yeah. It's love and rock and roll. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
So good.
By the way, for the record, I truly admire Mr. Rogers, and I will gladly accept any association with him. We all need that loving, nurturing energy now more than ever. It is now time for my sound advice. New music you need to know on the Allison Hagendorf Show playlist. Kicking off this week is the latest from today's guest, Mike Shinoda. This is the first solo song Mike has done in a while, where he writes, produces, and plays all the instruments himself. This song certainly marks a new era for Mike Shinoda, and I am here for it. Listen to his latest, Already Over. Also out this week is the solo debut from the legendary Mick Mars of Motley Crue. It's his first song since his recent retirement from the band, and it comes from his upcoming solo album, The Other Side of Mars, out February 23rd, 2024. Mick says, I wanted to do something that was just big and mean. I am what I am, and nobody else can do it. And like everyone, I've got a limited number of years, so I'm going to do all I can to do a lot of stuff. Check out this banger from Mick Mars, Loyal to the Lie. Next up is the band Dirty Honey. Their album Can't Find the Breaks is out today, and they are currently on their headlining Can't Find the Breaks tour after supporting Guns N' Roses on the road. They are part of the new school of classic-sounding blues-based rock and cite bands like Aerosmith, The Black Crowes, and Muse as influences. I'm loving this one off of their album. It's a gorgeous, timeless ballad. Check out Dirty Honey's Coming Home, Ballad of the Shire. That's my sound advice this week. Search for the Allison Hagendorf Show playlist wherever you listen to music. Thank you so much, as always, for being part of the Allison Hagendorf Show. New episodes drop every Friday, so make sure you follow and subscribe so you don't miss a thing. You can find the show wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can watch the show on YouTube. I would love to hear from you, so please like, comment, rate, review, whatever you're feeling, and reach out to me on socials at Allie Hagendorf. I would love to connect with you. Let me know who I should interview next and who I should feature on my sound advice. Thanks again. I'll see you next week. And remember, you're a rock star.